100 million years, we're presumed to have been involved in the origin of vertebrates from invertebrates, and the transitional forms that might show us how such a change occurred do not appear in the fossil record. Darwin anticipated that if his theory were to be demonstrably true, that the fossil record would have to show organisms that were progressively changing into different organisms. That is, we should see transitional stages between organism A and B, showing us at least some of the steps by which one evolved into another, and he was acutely aware that the fossil record was very short of such unambiguous steps. And indeed, very few have been found since. But 2 years after the publishing of The Origin of Species, a fossil was found called Archaeopteryx, meaning first wing, literally, or early wing. And Archaeopteryx seemed to be that much sought-after, seemingly ideal, intermediate stage between a reptile and a bird. I think, as most of you know here in this group, it is believed essentially universally by evolutionists that reptiles evolved into birds, that Archaeopteryx occurs, according to evolutionary view, about 150 million years ago in the fossil record in the so-called Middle Jurassic, and that sometime prior to that, perhaps another 50 to 100 million years before that, some reptile evolved into the organisms that in turn evolved into Archaeopteryx, and that Archaeopteryx perhaps went on to evolve into modern birds. And so the topics I would like to address this evening are, first of all, what do we know about the origin of flight? What do we know about the origin of Archaeopteryx? And was Archaeopteryx a bird? And if so, what is the evidence for that? And most specifically, I would like to focus on one particular issue, and that is the origin of feathers. Feathers, because birds are believed to have evolved from reptiles, feathers in turn are believed to have evolved from reptilian scales. And we will look very carefully at reptilian scales as they appear in the scanning electron microscope, and then we will look at feathers, the way they appear at both the light and scanning electron microscope, and determine for ourselves whether indeed there is evidence to believe that feathers have evolved from reptilian scales. Well, I guess my story of the origin of flight would have to begin with my flight out here yesterday on a DC-9. And as I sat in that DC-9, I looked about me, and it dawned on me that this airplane was constructed of approximately 2 million non-flying parts. And there I was in the middle of 2 million non-flying parts flying 450 miles an hour at 30,000 feet above the earth. I looked at the hinge on the latrine door, and I thought, that hinge is flying. I looked at sheet metal on the wings, and I said, that sheet metal is flying. I looked at the carpeting on the floor. I said, that carpet is flying. I looked at the seats were flying. I looked at the doors were flying. I looked at instruments in the pilot's compartment when I walked into the plane. I was quite sure that they were flying with us, rather hope they were. And it struck me how strange it is to have 2 million, approximately, to round off the number. I'm not sure exactly how many. That seemed like an impressive number. 2 million non-flying parts, which together, integrated into a DC-9, does indeed fly and was carrying me along with it. Now, nobody doubts that that airplane is the product of intelligent design. Whether or not we might be able to improve on it, come up with a better design, agree with the Douglas Corporation, whatever, whether Boeing, in fact, makes it better, airplane, as I've been told since I've been here. that's not the matter. The point is that an airplane is clearly formed to fly. And looking at any of its component parts, we do not have flight. Would it not then logically follow that a bird, which is infinitely more complex than a DC-9, I don't know about a Boeing airplane, but certainly a DC-9. Is it not then logical that birds themselves would have been designed and formed to fly. Evolutionists have a different view of the origin of flight and the origins of birds. They reject the concept that a bird and flight reflects design. Rather, they suppose or suggest that birds fly because random changes occurred in the genome of certain reptiles, which gave them the ability to do a variety of things which initially may have had nothing to do with flight. For example, some have suggested that an early reptile might have developed feathers to conserve body heat. After all, reptiles are cold-blooded creatures, and they might want to conserve some of the heat that they had accumulated during the day from the sun. Possibly they were a mechanism to stay warm. Other evolutionists have suggested that possibly early reptiles might have developed feather-like structures from scales by making a sort of an extension or a fringe on a scale to use as insect nets to catch insects. They would then scurry around in the desert using their forelimbs with extended fringe scales to catch insects, much as we might swing a fly swatter. A great deal of speculation has gone into how it is then you could go from a reptile that presumably scurried around on the ground with elongated fringe scales, and that how this reptile would take off and fly, called the cursorial theory of flight from the ground up. Other evolutionists have said certain reptiles climbed into trees, and when they got into trees, they risked jumping off. A risky thing to do at best, depending on how high you're up. And that those which happened to have a little flap of skin between the forelimbs, or perhaps happened to have scales that once again had become somewhat elongated with little crests or ridges, that they would be able to impact on the ground a little more gently than those who lacked this feature, and that therefore they would have survived, and those that didn't have this mechanism to dampen the fall would not have survived. So many, many speculations have emerged to tell us how a bird might have formed from a reptile, probably by a different route than directly flight, possibly through some other purposes such as collecting insects or thermal regulation. The problem with all of these kinds of stories is that they are just that, stories. For example, a distinguished evolutionist by the name of Joel Craycraft, who is an ornithologist and who published a book called A Dictionary of Birds, says this, and I quote, about the origin of birds from reptiles. He said, "But the problem remains, how are hypotheses about the origin of birds to be tested? The structure of Archaeopteryx can be reconstructed, and inferences can be made about its functional and mechanical characteristics. From this, scenarios about the transformation to the modern avian condition can be created." He's basically telling us that, yes, we can make stories about this. He goes on to say, "Thus, such narrative-type scenarios on evolution of flight, homeothermy, that is, warm-bloodedness. As you recall, reptiles are cold-blooded. Birds are very warm-blooded. And so he's talking about the origin of this, the warm-blooded state, and the origin of feathers or other characteristics can scarcely be scientifically tested." End of quote. So a distinguished ornithologist and evolutionist who doesn't doubt for a moment, I assure you, that birds evolved from reptiles, freely concedes that what we've really said about this is in the manner of a narrative or a scenario. And he freely concedes that we could tell these scenarios and narratives till, the cows come home? Possibly the birds come home? And that there would be no way to really exclude one scenario in preference to another, that none of them can really be scientifically tested. Well, this indeed is the nature of the problem. What about flight? What does it take to fly? What does it take to make a bird? What I'd like to do, sort of as a little background, is to establish what it is that makes a bird special, looking first at the skeleton, then looking at the physiology of the bird's body, and finally looking at feathers. If we can have the first picture and the lights out. Got control of the lights here. I guess this is it.
Okay.
This is a chicken. I think you probably recognize that already. It's not the feathered reptile, as it says in top, although some evolutionists would like to believe that birds are essentially feathered reptiles. But looking first at the skeleton, I will not go into all the distinctive features of birds, nor am I suggesting that all of these features are to be found in all birds, but there are some characteristics. First of all, the bird has a long, very flexible neck. You've probably noticed this on birds, how they can move their head about very smoothly. Sometimes, if you've seen owls, they seem to go all the way around in a 360. I think that's a bit of an optical illusion, but they can turn their head very easily. And they have more than the 7 vertebrae that are characteristic of mammals. They can have many more than 7 vertebrae, whereas mammals have 7 vertebrae, whether they're a giraffe or whether they're a mouse. Another characteristic of birds is that there's been a great deal of reduction in the number of bones in the skeleton. Bony parts become fused together, making the bird's skeleton rather like a box. So there's a considerable amount of reduction in bones and fusion of bone joints. Otherwise, all of the bony elements of the bird are fundamentally the same as any other vertebrate. There's clearly an underlying theme here. For example, this bone is called the humerus. It's the upper bone of the forearm. We have one. The bird has one. Going down to this part of the arm, the bird has a radius and an ulna. The radius is at the leading edge. The ulna, the posterior edge. It's the same in our arm. We have a radius here and an ulna back here. There's an elbow right in here. And then we go up to the hand, and there the bird starts to look a little different from us. Many of the small bones in the wrist are fused together. And when we get to the fingers, we see another area of bone reduction in birds. There are 3 fingers in the forelimbs of a bird. Embryologically, these 3 fingers apparently correspond to finger 1, 2, and 3 on us, whereas in dinosaurs, it is believed that the digits correspond to 2, 3, and 4. So there are different fingers used in 3-fingered dinosaurs and 3-fingered birds. And in birds, 2 of the 3 fingers are fused together, and 1 of the fingers is free. And that finger is usually attached to a feather, and it forms the so-called alula, or bastard wing, of the bird. And as we'll see in a moment, that extra finger with a feather attached to it creates a slot effect at the leading edge of a wing, just as we've learned to put into airplanes. And this allows us to create a slot and produce laminar flow over the wing to give more lift. The same principle occurs in a sailboat. The jib, out ahead of the mainsail, is a slot that funnels air through at high velocity over the convex surface of the wing, increasing lift. So birds had that all figured out long before people did for sailboats and certainly for airplanes. The bird flies by moving its entire limb up and down, starting from the shoulder blade here. And the feathers that they fly with are attached primarily in 2 places, to the trailing edge of the hand, and these are called the primary feathers, and to the trailing edge of the ulna, this part of the arm. These are, called the secondary feathers. And a bird appears to fly by pushing with the primary feathers like this to make it go forward, and using the secondary feathers along the ulna and shaping them to create lift like an airplane. So the primaries are more like the motor and the secondaries are more like the wing. You can imagine that as these wings flap up and down, and there's different types of flight, there is hovering flight like a hummingbird just staying in air. There is flapping flight, like a pheasant taking off, if you've ever done any pheasant hunting. And there's gliding flight, like many of the beautiful soaring birds, the albatross and what have you, and the gulls are capable of doing. The only form of flight that's understood even remotely in terms of its mechanics is gliding flight. Efforts to really fully understand flapping flight, and particularly hovering flight, have been a bit frustrated. One thing is quite sure, some extraordinarily powerful muscles are necessary to accomplish flight in a bird. Approximately 30% of the entire weight of a bird is devoted to the muscles that allow it to fly. And these two muscles are primarily muscles called the pectoralis muscles. We have them in our body. You see the weightlifters with these big chest muscles up here. This is the pectoralis major. It attaches to the collarbone. It attaches to the ribs. And it goes out laterally and attaches to the humerus. And we call this an adductor. That is, it pulls the limb down. And so, obviously, to fly, the bird has to have very powerful muscles to pull the limbs down. And these are the pectoralis muscles. These muscles attach largely to a bony structure in front, just as they do in us, the clavicles or shoulder, or collarbone rather. In the bird, these collarbones, instead of coming across like this, go down the front, and they fuse down here. You know what bone that is? Two bones going down the front, fusing. That's the wishbone, or the furcula, if you really want to get technical. Next Thanksgiving, you ask somebody if they want to pull the furcula with you. And this is the attachment point of the pectoralis muscle, and the fusion of the clavicles apparently takes some of the strain of the wings pushing on the shoulders of the bird and keeps the shoulders from just collapsing together under this powered flight by these immense muscles. Now, in addition to getting the wing down, one has to get the wing up. Now, in a sense, that's not a big problem. The wind will blow the wing up. You really need to pull it down with the pectoralis muscle. So the most important muscles in flight are the pectoralis. But there is a second set of muscles, and this is not to imply these are the only muscles involved in flight. These are the major ones. And these are called the supracoracoideus muscles. And the supracoracoideus muscles are primarily attached to the sternum down here, or keel. You know that cartilaginous keel you see on a chicken or a turkey? And these muscles also pull down. You might wonder, well, if these muscles are pulling down, how is that going to make the upper arm go up? We have some muscles pulling down here, but the arm has to go up. What you do is you run a little lanyard on the end of the muscle, bring it up to the shoulder, run it through a pulley, and bring it down to the outside of the arm. Now, when the muscle contracts, it pulls that little cord and the arm goes up. That's precisely what happens. There is a tendon that goes to a little hole in the shoulder joint and attaches to the upper part of the humerus that pulls the limb up. Now, when we look at Archaeopteryx, we notice while it has many of the features that are typical of birds, it has other features that are not, and some features are missing. And one that appears to be missing is the sternum. Since the sternum is part bone and part cartilage, we might expect the cartilaginous component to not be there anyway. Cartilage is rarely preserved in the fossil record. That doesn't mean that Archaeopteryx did have a keel or crina. We don't know. But we must be careful not to be dogmatic about that, because there has been a bony piece that apparently reflects part of the sternum, and whether it had an additional cartilaginous piece must be left up to speculation. I doubt we'll ever know that even with more specimens. The point is, flight is possible whether or not you have the sternum, because the most important muscles would have been connected to the wishbone. The wishbone is essentially unique to birds. Some evolutionists have argued that something like the wishbone has been found in reptiles. Not even all evolutionists agree on that point. So feathers are unique to birds, absolutely unique to birds, but the wishbone or furcula may also be unique to birds. What about Archaeopteryx? Did it have a furcular wishbone? Well, of the six specimens that include bones, at least two do. In fact, one shows a very robust, extremely well-developed wishbone. The whole function of the wishbone is to keep the shoulder spaced during flight. The wishbone actually flexes during flight, so it's hard to imagine what function the wishbone would have in an organism that didn't fly, such as, for example, a dinosaur. I might also point out there are other muscles that can make the limb go up. The deltoideus major, which is on the shoulder of the bird, can lift the wing of the bird. Another piece of evidence is it's possible to cut that tendon on the supracoracoideus that goes over the little pulley to pull the wing up. And if you cut this tendon on birds, they fly perfectly okay. So you do not need the muscles that are attached to the sternum to lift the wings. On the other hand, it does make it more difficult for a bird to engage in vigorous flapping flight if you cut these particular tendons, and so they have more difficulty taking off from the ground. Well, let's look elsewhere on a bird. Another very distinctive feature of birds are the pubic bones. The pubic bones are the two bones that meet and are fused above the genital organs of our body, and they're found on essentially all tetrapod vertebrates. And in the case of the bird, they're unusual because the pubic bones go to the rear of the animal, not to the front. Now, on some dinosaurs, the pubic bones go to the front, and in others, it kind of comes down at an angle. But to my knowledge, there are no dinosaurs that have a completely reverse-facing pubic bone, though this, again, is debated among paleontologists. Oftentimes, bones are kind of fragmentary, and it's hard to prove this one way or another. Birds, at least as they exist today, do not have a long tail. Instead, they have some fused vertebrae here called the pygostyle. But it's conceivable that a bird could have a very long tail, and certainly Archaeopteryx had a very long tail. 20 vertebrae, which while separate, were held together by ligaments so that Archaeopteryx was not an animal that could wag its tail like a dog. Rather, the tail would have protruded like a sort of a stiff element. And it had feathers attached to it. Looking elsewhere on the bird, we can find the hind limbs are rather different than the front. This is the upper bone right here, the femur. That would be comparable from our hip to our knee. Here's the tibia and fibula. That would be comparable from our knee to our ankle. And all of the rest of this is a foot. You think this is the feet of the bird. That's the toe. The toes are down here. This would be comparable to the tarsal bones of our foot and metatarsals. So the bird really walks right on the ends of its toes, and birds tend to have four toes altogether, actually three toes and a reversible toe back here called the hallux. Now, when birds perch on a limb, it shouldn't surprise you that they have to have feet uniquely suited to grasp a limb. Our feet are not well designed to do that sort of thing, to grip onto a limb and have the wind blow and we can stand on this twig. But with the hallux wrapping around, reverse-facing claw on it, the three toes in front wrapping the other way, it can grip quite tightly to the limbs. And this is a characteristic feature of birds. In woodpeckers, there are two toes that face to the rear and two to the front, so you have particularly powerful grasping toes there. They hang onto the tree like a pole lineman and bang away with their head, as you know. Fortunately, have a little cushion between their beak and their skull, or they'd knock themselves silly banging on the trees. Archaeopteryx does have this opposable hallux, and some of the fossils show it curved right around, and so it does appear to be a foot well-suited to being on a limb. Archaeopteryx has some remarkable differences from modern birds, one of which is the ribs do not appear to be locked together into an inflexible cage, as they are in a regular bird. And the sacrum back here is rather different. It had the long tail, as I pointed out, and Archaeopteryx has teeth. No modern bird or no living bird has teeth, but there were other fossil birds that did have teeth. Now, that doesn't prove that the animal evolved from a reptile, since there are many reptiles that don't have teeth either. Some do, some don't. Even among mammals, some have teeth, some don't. Even among people, some have teeth and some don't. So this in itself doesn't prove a great deal, except to say today there are no birds that have survived that have teeth. This shows you some detail on the muscles involved in flight. Here's a supracoracoideus. This is a little halyard that goes through the pulley-like affair up here, goes to the humerus and pulls the upper part of the arm up. And this is the wishbone here, and the attachments to the pectoralis up to here are able to pull a limb down. Next slide. This shows an example of two different birds to show how the attachment of the muscles can be quite different, and yet both birds quite capable of flying. These are examples of two living birds. This is the golden eye, and this is a pigeon down here. And you'll notice that the wishbone is right here on the golden eye. There's a big membranous ligament back here, and the pectoralis muscle attaches almost entirely to the wishbone and this membranous ligament. Down here on the pigeon, there's some attachment down to the sternum as well, or the so-called carina of the sternum. Next slide. Well, evolutionists at one time or another have implicated just about all of the reptiles as being ancestral to birds. This would include the crocodiles, the so-called thecodonts, and the theropod dinosaurs. Presumably, a ancestor of reptiles evolved into three different kinds of reptiles: the crocodiles, the dinosaurs, and the pterosaurs, the flying reptiles. At one time or another, it has been believed by evolutionists that birds evolved from each of these three. Today, almost nobody believes, oddly enough, that the flying reptiles evolved into birds because the flying reptiles are so specialized. There are some people that believe, because of similarities of the teeth of Archaeopteryx and the crocodile and some other features as well, that birds evolved from crocodiles, but the favorite belief today, currently, is that birds evolved from dinosaurs. Some even suggest that birds are dinosaurs. Dinosaurs aren't extinct. You see them sitting on nests and trees all over the place. That doesn't sell very well among a lot of other evolutionists, however. Then when we look at the dinosaurs, we see two basic groups. One, the so-called bird-hipped dinosaurs, and the other are the reptile-hipped dinosaurs. And now it's time for your test. Which of the two dinosaurs, the bird-hipped ones or the reptile-hipped ones, would be the logical dinosaur to have evolved into birds? Yeah, the bird-hipped. That's the one that no one believes evolved into birds. Eliminate the bird-hipped dinosaurs. There are superficial differences between the bird-hipped dinosaurs and the pelvis of birds, but evolutionists assure us that this is nothing more than convergent evolution. That is, two organisms not really related, each have evolved structures similar to one another, but we're not to take these similarities as being indicative of a common origin. That's lesson number one for you this evening, for those of you who will be dozing off on us a little later. Evolutionists themselves are quite aware that similarities between two organisms do not necessarily tell us anything about the evolutionary ancestry of an organism. Let me give you some specifics on that. The evolutionist Alan Fiducia, in his book called The Age of Birds, published by Harvard Press in 1980, says this: various birds, though unrelated, may come to resemble each other structurally through convergent evolution. You get the point he's saying? Birds unrelated can come to be very similar, not because they're related, but because two completely different birds have each evolved the same structures independently. Ah, we could be fooled on similarities in structure, in other words. How badly can we be fooled? Let's read on. He says, and I quote, "When comparing the structural or morphology, the structure or morphology of birds, in order to consider phylogenies, that is, in order to consider their evolutionary relationship, we must ascertain whether similar structures are homologous, meaning they can be traced back to a similar condition in a hypothetical common ancestor, or convergent and therefore not indicative of evolutionary relationship." Did you follow your way through that one? He says, when you look at two different birds and you see that they're dead ringers for one another with regard to one or more structural parts, we have to decide whether that similarity is a result of their having a common ancestor and having evolved from a common ancestor, or whether it's merely two unrelated organisms that have converged into forming the same appearance without being related. Wow, that could be a difficult task, right? But listen to this one. He says, we can speak of convergent evolution as applying to the whole organism or to specific features. He's now telling you that an entire animal can be a dead ringer for another and not be related. In an evolutionary sense, they may just simply be convergent. In fact, evolutionists would have no trouble giving you examples of that. You have two very different kinds of reproductive systems in mammals. You have the placental mammals, like us, that have a placenta. And then you have the marsupials that don't have a placenta, have a completely different way of nurturing the young during early stages of development, involving getting them completely out of the uterine cavity and attached to specialized nipples on the abdominal surface of the body in a pocket where the mouth literally fuses to the skin of the body. And they become attached and go through much of the differentiation in the pocket. Now, evolutionists are so convinced that placental development and marsupial development is so different that you can't think of a marsupial organism as being related to a placental organism in terms of evolution. But the intriguing thing is that there is a long list of very, very similar organisms that come in pairs, marsupial and placental. There are marsupial and placental flying squirrels. Very similar. They both have the skin between the legs and fly. There are marsupial and placental badgers. There are marsupial and placental mouse-like creatures. There is even a marsupial and placental wolf, the North American wolf being the placental one. The Tasmanian wolf, now almost extinct, if not extinct, is the marsupial one. They both certainly look like wolves. Evolutionists say they look like wolves, but they're not related, evolutionarily speaking, because they have such wildly divergent reproductive mechanisms. So in other words, the evolutionist has a way to utterly ignore similarities when it doesn't suit his explanatory purposes, or conversely, to make a great deal over a few rather small features that he would cite as evidence for evolutionary relationship, and you have to trust him, or her as the case may be, to know when to ignore the similarities and when to build a big case for the similarities. It's interesting that in a meeting in 1984 in Germany, in Eichstätt, Germany, a group of specialists in Archaeopteryx got together to discuss everything they knew about Archaeopteryx and to try to come to some conclusions. The intriguing thing is that the only conclusion that they could come to unanimously is that they fully agreed Archaeopteryx was a bird. They agreed on almost nothing else. They were so acutely aware of this state that they found it necessary to publish a statement at the beginning of the published proceedings of this meeting, spelled out in letters which are separated more widely than any other letters in the text, that they had all agreed to include the following sentence, and that is that they still believed in evolution and felt that it was a process absolutely necessary for biology. So in other words, we can't agree on a thing, but we don't doubt evolution for a minute. Well, anyway, to make the story a little shorter, it's the reptile-hip dinosaurs that then divided into herbivorous or herbivorous dinosaurs that eat plants and carnivorous dinosaurs, the theropods that eat flesh. And from these, we have at least two other groups, and it's believed that this group here may be ancestral to birds by the greatest majority of paleontologists, though not everybody would go along with that. Okay, next slide, please. These are the kinds of stories we hear about this so-called missing link, Archaeopteryx, that some particular reptile, essentially a dinosaur, evolved into a pigeon via this intermediate step. You'll notice the animal doesn't even hold its wings like a normal bird. Did you notice that right away? That's not the way the bird is in the fossil. That's the way they drew it. If they would have drawn it the way it was in the fossil, the wings would have been folded up tightly against itself, just as it is in a bird, to keep the feathers off the ground. But here the drawing is trying to show you that it held its wings out in front, something the bony structure of the bird doesn't even really allow, and that it was going along trying to catch insects with its wings. Now, trying to catch insects with wings with feathers on is one of the most inappropriate ways to catch insects I can think of. The draft or the air from bringing feathered structures together would literally blow the insect out of the way if it didn't scare them away. As far as feathers developing for thermal regulation, many evolutionists have pointed out that this is a singularly ludicrous idea because feathers are so incredibly complex. Why would anyone need a structure like this for warmth when you could accomplish the same thing with hair, as occurs in mammals? One evolutionist said at the meeting I just mentioned in Eichstätt that to believe that feathers evolved to keep a reptile warm would be comparable to believing that the heat shields in the space shuttle were designed to be used to insulate ice trucks. Next slide. This is a typical phylogenetic tree for birds, and it's rather typical of all phylogenetic trees that we see out at the limbs and tips of branches animals that really do exist. I believe in ostriches, owls, penguins, birds of prey, geese. They're all out on the ends of the branches. So what does this tell us we didn't already know? That these birds exist. Ah, the tree. Notice the branching in the tree. This bird branched off from an ancestor there. This bird branched off from an ancestor here. This one from this point. This one from that point. What would be interesting? Right here. This is what's interesting, right here. And right here is interesting. The common ancestor, the one that split to go two different directions. I want to know who's right here. Who do you see right there? Nobody. There's no information in this tree at all. All there is a subliminal suggestion, hardly documented or proved, that all of these birds evolved one from another via unknown common ancestors. Until you get to the bottom, they have a reptile down here. They've selected a thecodont. And oddly enough, they've shown Archaeopteryx as a little side channel here rather than on the trunk on its way towards the others. Here's Hesperornis over here, which is rather like a loon, had teeth and could dive in the water after the fish. So these kinds of phylogenetic trees convey no information whatever. They're virtually devoid of testable hypotheses or information. Next slide. Well, this is the critter in question. This is Archaeopteryx. It happens to be the London specimen. We see the long tail with 20, perhaps as many as 23 vertebrae, and paired feathers coming off from this tail via ligaments. This whole bird was about the size of a pigeon, maybe a little bigger. One specimen has been found quite recently, in 1987, as a matter of fact. It had feathers, too. All of these specimens come from a similar area in Bavaria called the Solnhofen quarries. And these quarries are unusual in that they have a particular kind of stone that has a very fine matrix. It's able to give the impressions in great detail, not only of the bones, but even of the feathers, so that we can see much of even the microscopic detail of the feathers in the fossil of this lithographic quality stone. By the way, you see this little V-shaped structure right here? What do you think that is? That is presumably the furcula or wishbone. It's a particularly robust one, and it is a bone believed to be lacking in other reptiles. Although some evolutionists suggest something similar has been found in some dinosaurs, this is debated. We see this grasping foot. See the hallux back here with the claw or nail pointed in? And then the three toes out here with the... This is the type of foot that could be considered a perching foot, like in modern birds. This is the pubic bone that faces towards the rear, more evident in other specimens. And notice the position of the wing. The humerus, radius, and ulna, up tight like this. This is the way birds carry the wings, not down here. When's the last time you see a bird walking around like this with the wings down and out in front? They're up tight like this. It's the way they are in the fossil as well. Okay, next slide. Notice the limbs aren't like that, the hind legs at all. That's the London specimen. This is the Berlin specimen. The feathers are particularly well shown here. And here the limb has been pulled out a little bit, but it's still a limb tucked up close to the body. Here are the hind limbs behind. And this one has the skull intact. The London specimen, the skull is badly fractured. The tail can be observed going back here with feathers emerging from the tail. Now, some have suggested Archaeopteryx is a hoax, even going so far as to call it the Piltdown chicken, believing that the feathers are nothing more than chicken feathers that have been applied to the skeleton of a dinosaur. I think if one focuses even on the skeleton of this organism and ignores the feathers, there are still significant differences, some of which I've already mentioned, between this organism and other reptiles. So I'm not convinced in the evidence, though I've read most of Hoyle's arguments, that this is a hoax. I do think Archaeopteryx is an interesting bird that had some unusual features not found in existing birds. And in this sense, it would be no different than something like a duck-billed platypus. What could we learn about evolution from a duck-billed platypus? We have a mammal that lays eggs, of all the ridiculous things for a mammal to do, and it has a beak like a duck. Does that tell us something about the evolution of the duck-billed platypus? I know of no evolutionist that suggests the fact that it lays eggs and has a beak like a duck means that it's related to birds. What do they say about it? They say this is an interesting mosaic animal. It has some interesting features reminiscent of other organisms, but that doesn't tell us anything about the evolution of this organism. I think that could very well be true of Archaeopteryx, too. Next slide. This is the wing of Archaeopteryx, and we notice that on the wing there are three. There is one free finger. It's doubtful that the other two fingers were free, but you can see nonetheless the claws in the end of the finger. And if you look over here at the wing of a pigeon, you see that the pigeon also has one finger free with a feather attached to it, and this is the feather that creates that alula or bastard wing that produces the slop effect to produce laminar flow at the leading edge of the wing. Not only do the feathers of Archaeopteryx look exactly like the feathers of living birds, even the relative numbers and their position on the wings is exactly like that of contemporary birds. In the middle is a little wing. This is a juvenile hoatzin, a bird that's found in South America, and it has very nice exposed fingers. The upper picture is a skeleton of a juvenile hoatzin. Look at those nice three fingers. This bird lives, is alive. It's not ancestral to anything that we know of. And it actually uses these limbs, the juvenile, to crawl around in the trees rather like a squirrel. And then as it matures, the fingers fuse together, as you see here, to give the condition in the adult hoatzin. So fingers on the wings do not necessarily tell us anything about the reptilian ancestry. After all, reptiles are not the only organisms to have fingers. And some birds have fingers and some don't that are exposed like this. They all have fingers, but they're fused. The ostrich and the ray have fingers very similar to the condition in Archaeopteryx as well. Next slide. This is the juvenile hoatzin. You can see the forelimbs here and the claws are used, presumably, for the bird to scurry about in the trees. Next slide. Now, the skull is also interesting. For a while, it was thought that the skull and brain of Archaeopteryx was distinctly reptilian. One of the problems is the skull was badly fractured in one of the most studied specimens, a London specimen, with large pieces of it missing. When the skull was carefully reconstructed in both the London specimen, when they dug into the fossil to really dig it out more, the pieces that were buried, and looked at the Berlin specimen, it emerges that the skull is very similar to that of living birds. First of all, characteristic of the bird skull is the fact that it has a sort of inflated look that mirrors the structure of the underlying brain. The frontal lobe of the brain here, the forebrain, is quite large, bulges up, and then the midbrain bulges out beside here on both sides. This is the area where the visual cortex is. It's very well developed in birds because they have these nice big eyes that are immovable. There's no muscles for them. That's why they have to move their head around so much. And then we have the cerebellum back here. That's also quite large in a bird, and the cerebellum is involved in coordinated movements. It's necessary, if you're moving quickly, to know when to stop your hand. It's necessary to combat the effects of gravity on your body. All of these structures are well developed in birds. They were well developed in Archaeopteryx. They are not well developed in reptiles. Another feature of Archaeopteryx discovered quite recently and reported at the 1984 Eichstätt meeting is that Archaeopteryx appeared to have a movable upper jaw. You may not be aware of this, but birds aren't like us or like me, where if you notice, my lower jaw has been doing a lot of this, but the upper jaw is fixed to my skull and remains steady. We move just the lower one. Birds can move both, the upper and the lower, and there is a hinge point back here, and the bone flexes right here. And this flexure point, a very thin part of the bone, appears to exist in Archaeopteryx much as it does in modern birds. A feature that modern birds do not have, or living ones, I should say, is teeth. But then not all fossil birds had teeth either. Some didn't, and some did. And it's not just reptiles that have teeth. Indeed, some reptiles have teeth, and some don't. There are no living birds with teeth. Now, Archaeopteryx didn't chew with these teeth any more than a reptile chews with teeth. It probably was used to grasp prey, and then to swallow it. Where is the bird's tooth or teeth? Down in the crop. They have stones that can grind the diet. And what's the advantage of having stones in the crop down here in the middle of the body rather than a lot of weight up on the head at the end of the neck? Center of gravity, right? If you're going to fly, you have to have a center of gravity. Years ago when I was a child, I built a model airplane out of sticks and bolts of wood and silk spread. And I wound up the propeller and I let it go and it did a loop-de-loop and hit the ground. The tail was heavier than the front end. I either had to reposition the wings or put some weight up front. So a bird has to have a center of balance when it walks in its hind limbs. And then as soon as it takes to air, it has to have an entirely new center of balance about its wings. And another little interesting feature of avian flight. And to do so, it keeps the weight at the center of the body. All the muscles are kept at the center of the body. The crop with the little stones in are at the center of the body. All of this provides a sense of balance for the bird. Next slide. So let's move on and talk about feathers. If we can have the light for a bit, I'll tell you a little bit about bird physiology and feathers, and then I'll show you some pretty pictures of feathers. Would it be enough to perhaps take a reptile, stick some feathers in it, as Duane Gish said once, kick it in the tail and watch it fly? Is that what a bird is? Is a bird a reptile with some feathers in it? My friends, there's no two classes of vertebrates more radically different than birds and reptiles. That's another take-home lesson for you if you're taking notes. There are no two classes of vertebrates more radically different than birds and reptiles. No two groups of vertebrates. Now, how are they different? Can you think of anything right off the bat that is totally different between a bird and a reptile? We've already mentioned it here. Not only different, but different to an extreme, not even close. Body temperature. What about reptiles? Body temperature. Cold-blooded. What about birds? Not just warm-blooded, but the most warm-blooded of all vertebrates. What about pulse rate? Reptiles, among the slowest. With amphibians, what's the fastest in pulse rate? Birds. In fact, the hummingbird is quite a winner in that category. I've got some figures here of what its heartbeat rate is, if I can find it. 615 beats a minute. The bird, in order to expend all of the energy that it does to fly, has to eat a highly efficient diet. To consume all of the oxygen that it needs to fly, it has to have highly efficient lungs. It has to have a highly efficient form of hemoglobin to bind that oxygen. A bird has all of these features. In fact, in the case of the lungs, it has a unique lung called a double-tied lung. It has a trachea going out the front, the way we do, to the mouth that goes into the lung. But then it has a tube going out of the back of the lung into air bags spread out among the muscles of the body and inside of the bones of the bird. All of this makes the bird very light because it's sort of a bag of air, or bag of wind, as somebody once called birds. And when the bird flies, the muscles of the body squeeze these bags, send the air out through the lungs. Also, they pull air back in through the lungs, and the air can oxygenate the blood on both the inhalation stroke and the exhalation stroke. The harder the bird flies, the more the air is pumped in and out of the bird, and the more it utilizes oxygen. Now, if you think about it, a bird doesn't have very many ways to breathe other than this system. How do we breathe? What two muscles? Diaphragm, a muscle that goes up and down in the middle. When it goes down, it expands the chest cavity and our lungs expand. Birds do not have a diaphragm. What other muscles do we use to breathe? Muscles between our ribs. When you eat ribs, you're eating the intercostal muscles that are used by many vertebrates to breathe. Bird can't breathe that way because its ribs are often fused together. So if it can't move, you ever eat ribs on a bird? It's a pretty skimpy meal, I'll tell you, bird ribs. Go to a ribs place and they feed you chicken ribs, you know you're really being starved out. So a bird can neither use the muscles between its ribs nor it can use a diaphragm to breathe. This means a bird breathes as it moves and as it flies, literally using its body musculature to breathe in flight. It has a particularly powerful form of hemoglobin to bind oxygen that allows it to fly even at high altitudes, where not only is the oxygen level low, but the temperatures are very low. And yet it has the ability to conserve body heat, to generate body heat, and to efficiently use air. Well, we could go down a very, very long list of how radically birds differ from reptiles, how they conserve weight. A bird even has one ovary to conserve weight rather than two. Anything you can do to cut the size of the weight, its gastrointestinal tract is very short compared to other animals, again, to conserve weight. Its skeleton is very light. A frigate bird with a 7-foot wingspan has a skeleton that weighs a grand total of 5 ounces. Even the feathers are heavier than the skeleton of most birds. The bird is streamlined. It has many other features. We'll not go into this anymore. Bird migration, there's nothing remotely comparable to it in any other organism. The golden plover, for example, takes off from Alaska and flies to Hawaii in the winter. It's no fool. It flies 4,000 miles nonstop in 88 hours. It eats a good meal before it flies, and when it flies, it flaps its wings approximately 250,000 wing beats. The animal starts out weighing 200 grams when it begins its trip, 70 grams of which is fuel in the form of fat. It has been calculated that 70 grams of fuel in a 200-gram bird are totally inadequate to provide the fuel necessary for this bird to fly 4,000 miles in 88 hours with 250,000 wing beats. How does it do it? It does it, as other birds do it, by flying in a V formation, just as I saw some geese doing today as we were driving along the road. And in this manner, by taking turns on the lead, the V formation conserves 23% on energy. They've got it figured that close for the trip. If they get blown too far off course, of course they could perish, although they do have good enough navigational ability that they can come back on course. Well, let's look at feathers. There's about 8,600 species of birds in existence today. How many birds do you think have been found in the fossil record? Any idea? Any guesses? 8,600 roughly species that we know of alive today. They're pretty fragile, so you might not expect too many in the fossil record. How many birds in the fossil record? In other words, how good a record do we have of birds? Approximately 2,000 species of birds have been observed in the fossil record in the form of either eggshells, or body parts, what have you. So it's not a trivial fossil record. They are all birds. They all have feathers. So thus it's believed that feathers evolved from reptilian scales by the evolutionists. Gerhard Heilmann in his book said, and I quote, "The most striking peculiarity of birds is their plumage, which apparently has nothing at all in common with the scaly covering of reptiles. So much more surprising is it, on examining these structures microscopically, to learn that the feather is nothing but a further development of the scale." Got that? A feather is nothing but a further development of the scale. It's like saying a computer is nothing but a further development of the mousetrap, because of flip-flop switches, you know. He said, "The feather may be considered a cylindrical fringe scale." Even the distinguished biologist and evolutionist Alfred Romer, who has forgotten certainly more about biology in his lifetime, now deceased, than I'll ever know, said in his book Man and Vertebrates, and I quote, "Birds have been called glorified reptiles. Feathers are in reality almost their only distinctive feature." Think of that. The man says that feathers are perhaps the only distinctive feature between birds and reptiles. Although these structures seem quite different from the horny scale that covers a reptile's body, the difference is in reality not very great. Okay, it's test time. Test time for everybody here. You've been told that there's very little difference between a feather and a scale, a reptilian scale. I want you to look very, very closely now. You're going to have to use all of your critical powers of observation. We're going to look at some feathers. Here's some color pictures. Let's look in the scanning electron microscope and now look at a reptilian scale. Next slide. Take a good look at this. This is a scale of a boa constrictor. Hard keratin here, soft carrot in the middle. This part has to be soft or it would be like a fishing pole. The poor snake wouldn't even bend. And I want you to look at this scale very carefully and implant in your mind this structure. Because the next picture will be a scanning electron micrograph of a feather, and I'm going to ask you to try with all of your ability to see if you can see any difference between this structure and a feather. Next slide is the feather. So then why do they tell us that the difference is not very great? Possibly the form of development of the scale and the feather is very similar. Nothing could be more dissimilar than the development of a feather and a scale. First of all, let's learn the parts of the feather. This is the shaft. The structure on either side is called the vane of the feather. The vane is made up of little rod-like structures that protrude from it at an angle, and these are called barbs. With us so far? Shaft, sometimes called the rachis. Vane on either side. The vane is made up of barbs. There are several barbs, and each barb has little barbs on it that look like a miniature feather. And these little barbs are called barbules. And there are barbules that point towards the tip of the feather called anterior barbules. And there are barbules that point towards the base of the feather called posterior barbules. Everybody with us so far yet? Okay. Let's look at the next slide. Evolutionists show us a picture like this and they say, look at how similar the development of a scale and a feather is. Bump on the skin for a starting scale in a reptile. Bump on the skin for a bird. So far they look pretty similar, don't they? Ectoderm, mesoderm. Ectoderm, mesoderm. The little bump starts folding over here. The little bump starts folding over here. Goes a little further up here. Goes, no wonder, they look identical, right? In two dimensions. In three dimensions, and as development progresses, it's starting to be hinted at here, we have two completely different structures. A scale is essentially taking a sheet of skin like this and folding it like so. And it's possible to have another sheet underneath it folded right along with it. And so when you shed, as reptiles do, the upper layer, what do you have waiting in the wings? A lower layer, and you never have to have the underlying tissues exposed to the air. It can be more than one layer thick. A bird wouldn't dare shed its skin. Why not? You couldn't shed the skin past the feathers because the feathers protrude through holes in the skin. So even the scaly skin in the legs of birds can't be shed as it is in the case of birds. The feather, in fact, is not a simple fold in the epidermis as the scale is. A feather grows out of what? Have you ever heard the name of the structure that the feather grows out of? It grows out of a follicle. A feather follicle. Have you ever heard of a hair follicle? Of course. Do you know why they call it a hair follicle? Because a hair grows out of a follicle. Have you ever heard of a scale follicle? No, you haven't. Do you know why not? Scales do not grow out of a follicle or anything that remotely resembles a follicle. It's the hair and the feather that are very similar, not the feather and the reptilian scale. Now, evolutionists don't make much of this fact because no evolutionist believes that mammals and birds have much to do with one another in terms of evolutionary development. If they preferred to believe that, they could line up a very long list of remarkable similarities between feathers and hairs. Between feathers and scales is essentially nothing. Let's look a little closer. Next slide. Here's our picture of reptilian scales, a boa constrictor. This is shed skin. What we're going to do is tip it upside down and look at the deep side. Okay, next slide. We're tipping it over. Now you see how the scale is formed. We could take our hand and tuck it right up in here into a little pocket. Here and here and here. In here. And there's another layer below it just like this. So when that sheds, the next layer is already waiting there. These are not follicle structures. They are folds in the skin. Let's look at the feather. Next slide. Feathers come in three basic forms. The regular contour feather that has a vane on either side has a quill. This fits through a hole in the skin and goes down into a follicle. Think of it, my friend. This feather has to grow out of a hole not much bigger around than this quilt. How are you going to get a feather to come up through a hole not much bigger around than the base of the feather, the quilt? Obviously, the feather has to be rolled up. It has to be folded up like a scroll. If this is the feather here, it has to be folded into a cylinder like this, and it's a cylinder that has to grow out of the follicle. We'll describe that more in a bit. Another type of feather is this one. This is the down feather. It doesn't have veins, and the reason it doesn't have a vein is that from the shaft, the barbs run in all which direction, and the barbs do not hook together to form a flat vein. Instead, they are separate like the branches of a Christmas tree. This feather is used to conserve body heat and to make nests. Then there's this feather. Ever see it? The phyllo-plume? If you pluck a chicken, hold it up to the light, there are little hairs that protrude from the chicken. Ever notice those? Those little hairs are the phyllo-plumes. They are a shaft looking very much like a hair, and at the end they have tiny little branching structures of bark. What on earth does a bird do with phyllo-plumes? They all have them. Current evidence indicates that like other feathers, the phyllo-plume has a follicle that's highly innervated with nerves. And it's believed that the phyllo-plume is what is called a proprioceptor, so that the bird can tell what position its feathers are in. This is a down feather. Notice in the down feather we have a shaft, we have barbs, but what's missing? No barbels. Therefore, the barbs just go every which way, and it makes a nice fluffy feather. This, by the way, is one cell from here to here. It's a dead cell. It's put together like pieces of bamboo. Next slide. Now, before we dig into the feather, we're going to give you a view of a feather that maybe a feather louse would see if it were to crawl into a feather. So it's going to be a very close-up view, and it's going to be possible to get lost inside of the feather. So you need to start thinking of where we're going. This is the shaft, the rachis. This is the quill down here. There's a little hole in the bottom where the blood vessels come in to keep it alive when it's down in the follicle. All of this is dead up here by the time it protrudes from the follicle. These are the veins, and these are the barbs. If we magnify this group of barbs right here, there are three barbs, and we see attached to the barbs are barbels, and the ones towards the tip of the feather are the anterior barbels, and the one towards the base of the feather are the posterior barbels. The ones towards the tip have hooks, about 20 hooks per barbel. So one feather will have about 400 barbs. Each barb will have about 800 barbels. And each barbel will have about 20 hooks that look like a violinist's fingers. It's been estimated that birds have several thousand feathers. A hummingbird has about 1,000. A swan in winter has about 25,000. And so the average bird has quite a goodly number of these little hooks and barbels. Indeed, it's been estimated that if I can get the figures on this, it's been estimated that a bird would have on the order of several hundred billion hooks on all of its collected feathers. Let's look at this in more detail. Next slide. Now we're looking at actual pictures in the scanning electron microscope. What's this structure? The shaft. These are the barbs. Notice the barbs have a little flexion point here. Back when this was down in the follicle, this would have been brought closer along the side of the shaft. It's allowed to swing open. And from the barb are the barbels. These are the posterior barbels. The anterior barbels are underneath on this side of the feather. Everybody with us so far? Archaeopteryx has all of these structures, by the way. Next slide. Now what we've done is we've removed the posterior barbels from the anterior barbels. Which one have we taken away? We've taken away the posterior because it's the anterior that have the hooks. Here are the hooks, and what do the hooks hook? They hook the posterior barbels that pass essentially perpendicular to them. That's what holds the feather together. You notice how you can tear a feather, it pulls apart. But once you pull the vein apart, what can you do? Put it back together again by grooming it. Birds do this all the time. They take their peak, they stir around in the gland back here, the only skin gland birds have, which is an oil or preen gland. And then they take that oil and they comb it on their feathers. This hooks all of the thousands and millions of unhooked hooks and puts a oil on the feathers so that the bird doesn't wet through in the rain. Notice that where you don't have hooks, the airspace is filled in by structures that completely cover over any potential gaps. Next slide. Now we have the angiobarbels barbels with their hooks in relationship to the posterior barbels, which run essentially perpendicular to one another. And we notice the hook has a nice curvature, and this curvature is precisely the same as the lip of a trough that runs down the length of the posterior barbel. A little bit complicated, isn't it? You realize the only reason this looks complicated is that this thing is simple enough for you to understand. If we were talking about a liver, which is really complicated, it wouldn't look complicated. It's too complicated for us to appreciate that it's complicated. Does that make any sense? A liver cell, all the liver cells all look alike, and they do several hundred biochemical functions all at the same time. You see one liver cell, you've seen them all. It wouldn't look complicated, but boy, is it complicated. This structure is simple. It's so simple it allows us to realize how complicated it is, because we can begin to sense that. These hooks then have to hook on this groove, and they do so by having the hook move through space. But the hook can't just move anywhere. The hook must stay in a particular plane. It has to move this way, but not that way. And it does so by having a hinge that allows movement in only one direction. You probably would have inferred this by looking at a reptilian scale the first time, right? Let's look at some detail of the hooks. Next picture. We're going to tip the feather over and look at it from the other side. Now the hooks are pointing down. These are the anterior barbels. And the hooks are going to have to hook to these underlying posterior barbels. The next picture will show them hooked. Next slide. Here the hooks are in place. The anterior barbel is running here, posterior barbel underneath. And look at these beautiful hooks that actually hook on grooves or troughs that run along the edge of the other barbel. Here is this beautiful hinge I was telling you about. It's like a broad, flat sheet of strap metal. You can bend it this way, but you can't bend it that way. And so the hook moves through space, and by merely preening the feather, a bird with its beak or we with our fingers, we can promote hooking of all of these structures. And finally, in the next picture, we see that feathers are not only beautifully constructed in terms of their morphology and their component parts, but they're beautifully colored as well. This is a peacock tail. And if we look at higher power through the microscope, next picture, we can see that that color extends, next slide, to a very deep level. We can begin to see the barbels on the barb. And these colors that we see on feathers are due to three sources. It's due to pigment actually inside the feather, like we have in our skin, black and brown pigments. It's due to double interference layers in the surface of the keratin, much as an oil slick on water produces color. The beautiful green in a mallard's head is due to interference phenomena of light hitting thin films on the surface of the feather. And it's due to materials that the bird consumes in its diet. The beautiful pink color of the flamingo is due to plankton in the diet of the flamingo producing carotenoids, which are excreted in the feather in much the same way that excretory products are secreted in our own hair. Once again, a tremendous similarity between feathers and hair. And in this way, the feather has color as well. Somebody once sent a letter to Darwin, and they said, "Darwin, what do you think of the peacock's tail? Isn't that a beautiful sight?" And Darwin, in his letter back, admitted that looking at a peacock tail sent fear into his heart. Why is it that Darwin found this beautiful sight of a peacock's tail a frightening thing to observe, and we look at it and enjoy it immensely? I suspect it's because Darwin had to worry a little bit about whether his theory of evolution could really account for the beauty that we see in the feathers of birds. I submit that the theory of evolution is, in fact, not a theory about the birds, but a theory for the birds. Thank you very much.